On our 100 city tour in Denver, Colorado, this is Democracy Now!
Harriet Tubman is one of the great American stories. A woman born a slave, illiterate for her whole life. She brought many, many people out of slavery through the Underground Railroad by time and again risking her own life to save others. She did intelligence for our army during the Civil War. She worked to get the women's suffrage movement going. It's a great American story.
From the Underground Railroad to the $20 bill, the Treasury Department announces it will feature the iconic abolitionist Harriet Tubman on the front, replacing former president and slave owner Andrew Jackson, who will be moved to the back of the bill. But some say to put Harriet Tubman on the $20 bill is an insult to her legacy. Then the untimely death of the legendary musician Prince. We'll look at the life and legacy of Prince. His gender-bending performances spanned funk, rock, and jazz. Then, as we broadcast from Colorado, marijuana is legal. We look at who stands to cash in on the billions generated by cannabis sales. We'll speak with the first African-American woman in Colorado to own a cannabis dispensary. She became politicized after her brother was arrested for marijuana and spent the next 4.5 years picking cotton at a Texas prison. And today is Earth Day. As leaders meet today at the United Nations to sign the Paris Climate Agreement, we'll look at a growing movement to stop the extraction of fossil fuels. Finally, Boulder, Colorado debates whether to become a sister city of Nablus in the occupied West Bank.
The scope of the human rights violations is enormous here. And this is not just based on my say-so or Israeli information.
For those who claim that they're appalled by human rights issues, they should be appalled by human rights issues. It is appalling. It is appalling the way that Israel is impoverishing the Palestinian people in the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The world is mourning the loss of the music legend Prince.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to get through this thing called life.
That's Prince performing Let's Go Crazy at the 2007 Super Bowl. He died at his home in Minnesota Thursday at the age of 57. He became a global music phenomenon in the 1980s with albums such as 1999, Purple Rain, and Sign of the Times. His inventive music spanned funk, rock, and jazz, while his gender-bending performances shattered expectations of gender and sexuality. President Obama released a statement saying, quote, "Today the world lost a creative icon. Few artists have influenced the sound and trajectory of popular music more distinctly or touched quite so many people with their talent," Obama wrote. Across the country, fans and fellow artists celebrated Prince's legacy, including Stevie Wonder, who spoke with CNN's Anderson Cooper.
He just passionately loved music. It's like when musicians can jam, there's nothing like it in the whole world.
I don't want to put you on the spot. Is there any song you want to sing a little of or play a little of? Or, again, I don't want to put you on the spot if you're not up for it.
Yeah, I think I would probably break down.
Okay.
If I do a song right now. But, you know, he was incredible. And I'm just glad that I was able to say to him, I love you, the last time I saw him.
Today is Earth Day, and climate is on the world's agenda as more than 60 heads of state are slated to meet at the United Nations headquarters in New York to sign the Paris Climate Agreement aimed at slowing climate change. This comes as the Earth has experienced 11 straight months of record-shattering temperatures. Experts say the greenhouse gas cuts promised in the Paris Climate Deal are insufficient to avert dangerous global warming. We'll have more on the Paris Agreement signing with Antonia Juhas later in the broadcast. Meanwhile, scientists say the Great Barrier Reef is more than 90% bleached, a result of warming ocean temperatures due to climate change. Severe reef bleaching kills coral, which is home to a quarter of all marine species. James Cook University professor Terry Hughes, who led the research, tweeted, quote, "I showed the results of aerial surveys of bleaching on the Great Barrier Reef to my students, and then we wept." Mexican oil giant Pemex has raised the death toll from Wednesday's petrochemical plant explosion to 24. Another 136 people have been injured. It's the latest in a series of deadly disasters at Pemex facilities in recent years. Meanwhile, Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto has proposed legalizing marijuana-based medicine and releasing some prisoners serving time on minor drug charges. This comes as a number of Latin American countries push back on the U.S.-led war on drugs during a special session of the U.N. General Assembly this week. Suicide rates in the U.S. have hit a 30-year high, with particularly high surges in the rates for women and middle-aged people. Researchers said the spikes may be linked to a drug epidemic among white Americans and increasing economic instability. Harvard professor Robert Putnam said, quote, "This is part of the larger emerging pattern of evidence of the links between poverty, hopelessness, and health." In New York City, the Board of Elections chief clerk, Diane Haslett-Rudiano, has been suspended without pay after the election board purged more than 120,000 Brooklyn Democratic voters from the rolls. The New York Attorney General's office received more than 1,000 complaints election day. Both his office and the city controller have launched investigations. The head of a Western-backed rescue group in Syria, known as the White Helmets, has been refused entry into the United States, where he was slated to receive a humanitarian award. Ra'id Salah landed at Washington's Dulles International Airport Monday, only to be told his visa was canceled. He was put on a flight back to Turkey. The State Department's refused to provide details. His group, the Syria Civil Defense, is famous for the thousands of volunteers wearing white helmets who rescue people trapped in rubble after airstrikes. Britain's issued a formal travel warning to LGBT travelers leading to Mississippi and North Carolina following the passage of anti-LGBT laws in the two states. This comes as a handful of other U.S. states are considering similar legislation. FBI Director James Comey suggested the agency paid more than $1 million to hack into the iPhone of suspected San Bernardino shooter Syed Farouk after Apple refused to offer the FBI a backdoor into the phone. The legal battle between the FBI and Apple ended when the FBI said it had cracked the iPhone without Apple's help. And family members and friends have launched a 5-day vigilant hunger strike to mark the first anniversary of the death of Samuel Harrell, an African-American man who died April 21, 2015, after as many as 20 corrections officers kicked, punched, and threw him down a flight of stairs while he was incarcerated at the Fishkill Correctional Facility in Beacon, New York. The group of officers who assaulted Harrell are known as the Beat Up Squad. Activists gathered outside the prison Thursday night, where Jeff Golden spoke out.
Exactly a year ago here tonight, a gentle 30-year-old man named Sam Harrell, who was doing time on a drug charge, was brutally murdered by as many as 20 corrections officers, all of whom are still on active duty.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're on a 100-city tour marking Democracy Now!'s 20th anniversary. Tonight, we head to Colorado College. Right now, we're broadcasting from Denver, Colorado. U.S. Secretary of State Jack Lew has announced the new $20 bills will feature iconic abolitionist Harriet Tubman on the front, replacing former president and slave owner Andrew Jackson.
Harriet Tubman is one of the great American stories. A woman born a slave, illiterate for her whole life. She brought many, many people out of slavery through the Underground Railroad by time and again risking her own life to save others. She did intelligence for our army during the Civil War. After she worked to get the women's suffrage movement going. It's a great American story.
That was U.S. Treasury Secretary Jack Lew. The move comes after more than a half a million people voted for Harriet Tubman to replace Jackson. But in fact, President Jackson will not be removed entirely, simply moved to the back of the bill. Some have criticized the idea that Harriet Tubman should represent U.S. currency at all. In a 2015 essay that went viral again yesterday, the writer Feminista Jones wrote, quote, "If having Harriet Tubman's face on the $20 bill was going to improve women's access to said bill, I'd be all for it. But instead, it only promises to distort Tubman's legacy, rooted in resisting the foundation of American capitalism." Well, for more, we're joined by two guests. In New York, Stephen Thrasher is with us. He's a weekly columnist for The Guardian U.S., where he wrote a piece headlined, "To put Harriet Tubman on the $20 bill would be an insult to her legacy." Here in Denver, we're joined by Winston Grady Willis. He is professor and chair of Africana Studies at Metropolitan State University here in Denver. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! We're going to start with the professor here in Denver, Colorado. Professor, talk about who Harriet Tubman was. Give us a thumbnail sketch of this remarkable woman's life.
Thank you, Amy. She was a remarkable woman indeed. She was born into slavery in Maryland. She was initially slated to work in the big house, but was seen as being too recalcitrant, and so was placed in the field, which is the experience for the large number of enslaved African women and men. She
was born in 1822 in the Eastern Shore of Maryland?
Correct. In Maryland. She would eventually escape from slavery, but realized that her own individual freedom from chattel slavery simply was not enough. And so she dedicated the rest of her life to this ongoing mission to free family members, friends, individuals who did not know her directly. She became the most prominent conductor with the Underground Railroad.
I mean, it's interesting. She escaped slavery like 10 years after Frederick Douglass from the same area
right.
he also enslaved.
Right.
He goes north, becomes a world-renowned speaker against slavery.
Yes.
But she comes back to the place where she had been brutalized,
right?
They said she experienced these epileptic-like seizures because she had been beaten so badly around her head.
That's right. And she would live with this lifelong disability, yet help empower individuals to escape from slavery. And the key thing, the relationship between Douglass and Tubman, Douglass, along with Sojourner Truth, are quintessential examples of political abolitionists. And Tubman is what I would call a military abolitionist. Many folks would refer to her as Moses, but a number of enslaved Africans, others in the Underground Railroad, often refer to her as the General.
And talk about, she not only was a conductor, as they say, on the Underground Railroad, coming back, freeing hundreds of slaves, but she fought in the Civil War.
She did indeed. She was a spy, she was a scout, and most famously, perhaps, she was the individual who led the raid down the Combahee River in the Low Country of South Carolina. It was a nighttime raid in which she led forces that U.S. Army forces, often referred to as Union forces, who freed dozens of enslaved Africans, eventually hundreds, under Confederate fire. Not a single individual was lost.
Hmm. Afterwards, after her position fighting in the Civil War, it took her decades to get a pension.
Absolutely.
Is that right?
Absolutely. It was a decades-long struggle, and then when she finally did receive that pension, it was an absolute pittance. There's no question about it.
And slave owners put a bounty on her head?
Yes, absolutely. I often think of, when we think of the bounty that Assata Shakur has on her head, I'm reminded that there's a long tradition of individuals going back to Tubman herself who were deemed such a threat to the status quo.
Stephen Thrasher, you wrote about Harriet Tubman be replacing the slave-owning president, Andrew Jackson, on the front of the bill. He'll be pushed to the back of the bill. Your thoughts on this iconic abolitionist, her face on the most used bill in the United States?
I had very mixed feelings about it, and I don't disagree with anything the professor said about what a fantastic and wonderful American she was. And I do understand people who think that this is an opportunity to have her have more visibility. But I'm really concerned about it because Harriet Tubman was, you know, a slave herself. She could have been bought or sold with a $20 bill. And her work was about undoing the system of oppression of African Americans. And so I really worry that in being placed on the bill, that will be sort of a way of papering over her true legacy and sort of be a way to just say that things are being taken care of and are no longer problematic. I would be entirely for the Harriet Tubman Reparations Act of 2016. You know, if I know this Congress would never pass such a thing and President Obama probably wouldn't sign it. But I'd be all for having something happen where Harriet Tubman was used to address the economic inequality of African Americans still to this day. But I'm really worried about seeing her face on this bill, starting to see her face on mattress sales or, you know, electronic store sales or things like that, and just seeing the American dollar, you know, consume one of our heroes who is really about undoing the ways that American capitalism used our bodies to capitalize this country.
I wanted to read you a quote from NPR pointing out that putting Tubman on the $20 bill would be poetic because of a special historical resonance that's the same amount she eventually received from the U.S. government as her monthly pension for her service as a nurse, scout, cook, and spy during the Civil War, as well as her role as for her status as the widow of a veteran. Stephen Thrasher, your response.
I would be more persuaded that that was useful now if we were at a place where African Americans and African American women were earning, you know, equal pay and had equal wealth. But the fact of the matter is that right now, white families have about 12 times the wealth of black families in this country. Black women earn something like 64 cents on the dollar to white men. And so we're still living in a time that over the course of decades and centuries has been created an economic inequality from the time that Harriet Tubman was doing her work. And these things haven't been addressed. You know, we have, of course, racial disparities that happen across millions of people. But there's specific companies like, as I wrote in my piece, Aetna Insurance, that they insured slaves, they made their money off of slaves, they made their wealth off of slaves, that very much fueled the economy of this nation for hundreds of years. And that led to these disparities that we still have. And those specific things are not being addressed. So to then take Harriet Tubman, one of our best images and one of our best people who was fighting that, and then to now put her on the dollar that is still economically oppressing black people, I think really misses a very important point.
Professor Winston Grady Willis, this whole issue of her representing capitalism.
Yes. I think that Stephen Thrasher makes a really important point. His piece is excellent, and he and a number of other individuals, political prisoner, freedom fighter, Jahlil Montequin, make very, very important points here. And so in many ways, I'm actually in agreement. But at the end of the day, perhaps it's the practical bones in my body. I think that having Tubman as the face on the $20 bill actually provides an opportunity for a number of us to go beyond an elementary school narrative and discussion of her life and legacy. She is an extraordinary figure. And given the place of enslaved African men and women, and specifically the marginalization of enslaved African women, the absolute absence of ownership over their bodies, Tubman's activism, her agency, stands in stark contrast to that. And I think it's very, very important for folks to not only understand that, but to also, in a society in which heroism, when connected, when gendered, when seen in connection to womanhood, is often always placed in exclusively white terms, to have Tubman given prominence in this way is profoundly important and something that should not be.
I'm going to put this quote to you, Professor Winston Grady Willis. Akiba Solomon, writing in the racial justice publication Color Lines, commented, "Several people have suggested that Tubman on the front, Jackson on the back, is a late April Fool's joke or the product of a 420 binge. It's neither. It's America." Yeah. And for our viewers and listeners around the world outside of Colorado, you can explain what a 420 binge is before you respond.
Absolutely. I think I may have had some students in class who may have been recuperating from that celebration of marijuana use.
And that's right. Yes. 420, folks, which we just passed. We were a little careful driving on the roads, but April 20th is a celebration of marijuana. And because it's legal here in Colorado, enormous day.
Yes, yes.
But what about that? Jackson on the back, Tubman on the front.
Andrew Jackson is arguably a war criminal. He is someone who was unapologetically a slaveholder and an individual who played a very critical role with respect to the genocide of indigenous populations. And so the positionality, the juxtaposition of this woman who escapes slavery, who would go on to command the respect of U.S. Army generals, to sort of supplant Jackson, that's not lost on any of us. It's not lost on any of us.
Jackson was one of 18 presidents who owned slaves.
That's correct.
Interestingly, he was not only a slave owner, but participated in the genocide against the indigenous population, the Cherokee people calling him Sharp Knife, indicating his extreme violence against them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so, again, with all of the contradictions, the ironies that are in play here, what cannot be lost is that those of us who do the work, whether grassroots activists, whether educators, we have a responsibility to take this moment and to celebrate Tubman on our own terms. We've seen already that the mainstream corporate media, that individuals in high places often will have a particular narrative, whether it's on Dr. King and his holiday, which is really a social justice movement holiday. But it's incumbent upon us. It's our obligation to take this moment, in terms of the $20 bill, to reaffirm Tubman's place, what she represents in terms of black womanhood, black agency, and the bedrock and central importance that blacks themselves played during the U.S. Civil War.
We're going to switch gears right now, but ask the two of you to stay on with us. The world mourning the loss of the hugely acclaimed and influential musical sensation Prince. He died Thursday at his home in Minnesota at the age of 57. Prince became a global musical phenomenon in the 80s with albums such as 1999, Purple Rain, and Sign of the Times. His music spanned funk, rock, and jazz. He sold more than 100 million records during his career. On Thursday, President Obama released a statement on Facebook that read in part, quote, "Today, the world lost a creative icon. Few artists have influenced the sound and trajectory of popular music more distinctly or touched quite so many people with their talent." Stephen Thrasher, your new piece for The Guardian is headlined, "Prince Broke All the Rules About What Black American Men Should Be." Take it from there.
Yeah. Of course, like everyone else, I was extremely shocked and sad when I heard about Prince's death, and I didn't know what to make of it necessarily right away, and I wasn't sure what I could add to what this genius had to offer. And I quickly started thinking about the ways that he really frightened me as a young man, and yet I couldn't look away. I grew up biracial, black and white. My father was black and my mother was white. And I often was trying to straddle what it meant to be a biracial person, what it meant to be a black person. And Prince really spoke to me both in the way that he dealt with race in a very explicit way, and that he was also, like me, kind of light-skinned, but he very much owned being a black person. And I was absolutely thrilled and terrified when he spoke back to Warner Brothers, when he wrote Slave on his cheek, and when he, you know, this, I was trying to think about the connections between him and Harriet Tubman. Obviously, I'm not comparing chattel slavery to being, you know, a Sony musician, but Prince really dealt with economics on his own terms, and he said he wasn't going to do whatever Warner Brothers or his publisher wanted him to do. He was going to take ownership of his own music and chart his own path. And so I found that really inspiring and terrifying. Also, as a queer person who didn't know that I was gay when I was quite young, I found Prince just titillating and really frightening. And again, I couldn't look away because he had this quality that was profoundly sexual, but created a broader sense of sexuality than I was used to considering. He had a way that I thought was very paradoxic of trying to expand the notion of what it meant to be a man, and yet at the same time he was really deconstructing gender, and he wasn't owning being a man or owning a woman. So in retrospect, I wasn't thinking of this when I was in junior high school, but when I think back on the work and the writing I've done around race and gender and identity to this time, I realize seeing Prince was one of the first times I saw someone who refused to live in a binary. And when he named himself the artist formerly known as Prince, or rather used that symbol, he was really refusing to play by the game that society had put forth for him and said, I'm going to do this on my own terms. And it was really super fascinating to read yesterday about what it meant when he put that symbol out, because at the time, we didn't have emojis. We didn't sort of have the graphic environment we have with the internet now. Newspapers literally could not print what that symbol was. And at some point, they had to send out floppy disks to publications so that they could have a special font to be able to print that. So that's what I was thinking about yesterday, just the many ways he made me reconsider what it meant to be a man, gender, black, and an American.
And finally, Professor Winston Grady Willis.
I really couldn't agree more. And I know that personally, Prince's significance growing up here in Colorado was that there'd come a point where, just in terms of the culture wars around music, when I was in high school and in college, those individuals who gravitated toward R&B, disco, on the one hand, and those individuals who proudly proclaimed that they were rockers, and this was often a racialized dynamic, usually found themselves all on the dance floor, all grooving to Prince. And this was really, really important culturally. It was important personally. And the gender piece is really important because for those of us who are heterosexual, Prince forced us to really interrogate gender norms in ways in which we were often not comfortable. I mean, I still remember to this day, every time Dick Clark would introduce Prince, there was this unease. And yet there was, all at the same time, this incredible respect for his genius.
I want to thank you both for being with us. Stephen Thrasher, columnist for The Guardian U.S., will link to your piece. To put Harriet Tubman on the $20 bill would be an insult to her legacy, as well as your piece on Prince. And Winston Grady Willis, professor and chair of Africana Studies here at Metropolitan State University in Denver, Colorado. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, the first African-American woman to own a pot dispensary, a marijuana dispensary here in Colorado. Stay with us.
Don't matter tonight.
Money Don't Matter Tonight by the late, great, gender-bending, jazz, funk, rock and roll, yes, the legend, Prince, who died at the age of 57. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're on our 100-city tour marking Democracy Now!'s 20th anniversary. Today, we're in Denver, Colorado. Tonight, I'll be speaking at Colorado College in Colorado Springs. But here in Colorado, 2012, the state voted to legalize the recreational use of marijuana. Marijuana has become an established part of the economy here. There are marijuana dispensaries on many street corners. Now, 23 states in the District of Columbia have legalized marijuana for either medical or recreational use, and the cannabis industry is one of the fastest growing in the U.S. But some have questioned who stands to cash in on the billions being generated by cannabis sales. Michelle Alexander, best-selling author of The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness, addressed the issue in a conversation with the Drug Policy Alliance.
In many ways, the imagery doesn't sit right. You know, here are white men poised to run big marijuana businesses, dreaming of cashing in big, big money, big businesses selling weed. After 40 years of impoverished black kids getting prison time selling weed, and their families and futures destroyed, now white men are planning to get rich doing precisely the same thing.
The Marijuana Arrest Research Project reports between 2001 and 2010, Colorado police made 108,000 arrests for marijuana possession. African Americans were more than 10% of those arrests, but are less than 4% of Colorado's residents. For more, we're joined by Wanda James, CEO of the Denver-based cannabis dispensary Simply Pure. She's the first African-American woman in Colorado to own a cannabis dispensary. She's also managing partner of Cannabis Global Initiative. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
It's great to have you with us. I mean,
Thank
for
you.
People hearing that you are publicly saying that you own a pot dispensary, explain the alternative reality here in Colorado compared with everywhere else.
Sure. I had been publicly saying we own a dispensary since 2009. So this is not new to us, and we became part of this pot industry or cannabis industry because of social justice. We wanted to be able to step out and talk about this in political terms and to be able to bring normalcy to the idea that cannabis is a part of the American lifestyle and the American fabric. So this is something that I'm very proud about. Of all the things I've done in my life, I would say this is probably the thing that I find the most proud
of. So how does it work? How does your dispensary work?
Like any other retail operation that you would go through, you've got to be licensed by the state. You've got to work within the realm of the rules and the regulations, which are many. Over the age of 21, you can come into a dispensary, show us your ID, and you can buy cannabis and cannabis-infused products.
Mm-hmm. So you're talking not only about actual marijuana, but you specialize in edibles.
Yes. Simply Pure is an edible company in 2010. It's now a dispensary. But, yeah, my husband is one of the best-known, Scott Durah, one of the best-known cannabis chefs in the country. So he cooks for people having end-of-life issues, and he also cooks for people who are having great time with recreational festivities, such as weddings and birthday parties. And
so sort of pot-infused wedding cakes?
Exactly. All meals. I mean, anything that you eat, we can infuse.
So now talk about the disparities between marijuana arrests and sentencing for people of color outside of Colorado and what this means and who profits from marijuana sales.
So this is the absurdity that I think people really need to understand what's happening here, is America needs slave labor. Since the dawn of America, since it began, we have had a slave labor class. What we see now is the privatized prison system, and won't get into a whole lot of details, but if you can name a corporation right now, they are profiting off of labor and slave labor given by privatized prison systems. To fill those spots, they need to be able to put bodies into those prison systems. And those bodies right now are being collected on the streets of America through cannabis arrest. We're seeing last year alone that 701,000 people were arrested for simple possession of cannabis. Of those 700,000 people, you are four times more likely to be arrested if you are black. So when you start to look at the fact that you are being targeted as a people for these arrests to become part of the prison system, to be able to work into slave labor, it becomes extremely concerning.
Can you talk about what happened to your brother, Wanda James?
Yeah. At 17 years old, my brother got caught with 4.5 ounces of cannabis. He was in Texas. He never saw an attorney. He and his mother went in front of the judge. The judge made my brother a felon. My brother spent 4.5 years picking cotton for free in Texas. I always stop on that note and I say it again, that my black brother, my black 17-year-old brother, spent 4.5 years picking cotton for free in Texas to gain his freedom. That was in 1992. Not 1892. This is absurd to me. And when we discovered this, I became incensed by it. Because as a student on the campus of the University of Colorado, we smoked cannabis regularly. We smoked it in front of CUPD that just told us to put it away. Put it away, kids. You know, put it away. I didn't even know until I met my brother at 35 that people were actually arrested for cannabis. In my world, in my wealthy world of lawyers and doctors and college-educated people, we don't go to jail for cannabis. Everybody else does. 700,000 arrests last year for cannabis possession.
If you have a criminal record for marijuana, how does that impact your ability to enter the industry?
You can't. You have to be 10 years removed from any kind of a drug felon. Now, you can have other felonies and other issues with the law and still own dispensaries in Colorado. However, you can't have any drug felonies. It's become extremely difficult to get into the industry. And I have to also point out that the negative perception given to people of color through churches and through our elected officials also helps stop people from wanting to be involved in this industry, which is another travesty that we are once again being left out of this brand new industry and one of the largest industries that we're going to see in this country.
Talk about the Denver City Council moving to restrict new pot businesses in the city. What sparked that? What are your thoughts?
What sparked that was they said that there were too many marijuana grow facilities in poor neighborhoods. However, Denver City Council is the one that controls zoning, and they are the one that told us where we had to be and where we were allowed to grow. So then 5 years later, they figured that there are too many there, even though that these organizations have been good neighbors, have cleaned up the area, have hired people for higher wage jobs, which is always a positive in this industry.
The black community in Colorado, its position on pot legalization and...
I mean, I can't speak for the entire black community, but I will say the response to me and people wanting to work for me is overwhelming. I get letters daily from people wanting to be a part of the industry, wanting to be working in our dispensary, from college-educated people to people that are just starting out.
Can you finally talk about the role of women, particularly black women, in this white, male-dominated industry?
It's almost non-existent for black women. There are few to none. I've asked the question many, many times of how many black women actually own dispensaries, and I can't seem to get that answer. So it is an extremely limited number. However, women in this industry are coming full circle. We've seen about 36% of the management positions in this industry are women. We've got probably about a 20 to 22% ownership in this industry, or in Colorado, of women-owned businesses in the marijuana industry.
Wanda James, I want to thank you for being with us. We will come back to you even when we leave Colorado. Wanda James, CEO of Simply Pure, Denver-based cannabis dispensary, managing partner of
Cannabis Global Initiative.
Cannabis Global Initiative. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. As we move on right now, today is Earth Day. Climate is on the world's agenda as more than 60 heads of state will meet at the United Nations headquarters to sign the Paris Agreement aimed at slowing climate change. Many countries still need to formally approve the agreement, which will only enter into force when it's ratified by 55 nations that account for 55% of man-made greenhouse gas emissions. This comes as the first 3 months of 2016 broke temperature records, and 2015 was the warmest year on record. Experts say the cuts promised in the deal are insufficient to avert dangerous global warming. On Thursday, demonstrators gathered in Paris to highlight the oil industry's role in climate change.
I don't On se retrouve ce matin devant le Méridien.
So we are gathering outside the Meridian this morning because it is the International Oil Summit, a yearly summit which gathers major oil industries and some organizations such as OPEC, as Paris's climate agreement will be ratified tomorrow in New York. And we wanted to underline the fact that there is a huge contradiction there since the climate agreement plans to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees, which was the commitment of all countries. But if the oil industry continues that way, we are going to overpass 3 degrees, which is the climate imbalance threshold. And that is when the situation will become difficult to deal with.
Here in the United States, Gulf Coast communities marked the 6th anniversary of the BP oil spill by demanding no new drilling. Last month, they held protests outside the Superdome in New Orleans, which hosted an auction by the Interior Department for 45 million acres in the offshore Gulf of Mexico for new oil and gas drilling. For more, we're joined here in Denver by reporter Antonia Yuhas. Her new report in Rolling Stone headlines 6 years after BP, Gulf oil spill, residents demand no new drilling. And she has a piece in Newsweek. It's headlined, Paris was just a way station in the climate change fight. You can read her feature article in Ms. Magazine about women taking on climate change. And her most recent book, Black Tide, The Devastating Impact of the Gulf Oil Spill. It's great to have you back with us, Antonia, here in Denver, Colorado. Today.
Thanks.
Well, these three things are converging. It's Earth Day. You've got the Paris Climate Agreement going to be signed at the UN today. It's the 6th anniversary of the BP oil spill. Put it all together for
okay.
us.
I think the most important thing for the 6-year anniversary of the oil spill is that, you know, at this point, government, industry, the public have learned the lessons of this disaster. Unfortunately, those first two categories, government and industry, aren't implementing any of those lessons. So President Obama is expanding offshore oil drilling dramatically in the Gulf of Mexico, a proposal to expand it in the Arctic, continuing production where I live in California in the Pacific, and hoping to continue to expand drilling in the Gulf of Mexico as well. And that is in face of the Interior Department trying to put in place new regulations to make offshore drilling safer, including 500 pages worth of new regulations released just last week. But every expert I've spoken to, including the U.S. Chemical Safety Board, has said these regulations just do not go far enough, and the lessons have not been implemented. The likelihood of another Macondo-like blowout is still very, very real. The good news is, of those groups, the groups that have learned the lessons, increasingly so, is the public. So, you know, in my 6 years of covering this disaster, I don't think I've ever seen anything like that protest at the Superdome. Just the numbers of people from the Gulf Coast, from all across the Gulf Coast, coming out to say, you know what, we just don't want any more of this. The costs are too high, the environmental costs, but also the economic costs with the collapse in the oil industry and that roller coaster ride of being dependent on this resource, and of course, the climate costs. And what we're seeing in the Gulf Coast is reflected all across the country and all across the world, where polls are showing really dramatic changes in public opinion, not just globally, but also in the United States, with almost 75% of Americans now preferring to pursue alternative energy instead of oil and gas development. And that includes, for the first time, a majority of Republicans proposing alternative energy to oil and gas, which means that, for example, the Republican candidates for president are not reflecting the views of the Republican population, but instead what we're seeing is a population that is saying, embracing the idea of keep it in the ground.
What's happening at the United Nations today? Some 60 heads of state will be there to sign the Paris Agreement. Its significance.
Yeah, so you know, this was 196 countries agreed in Paris in December that we're going to make a global commitment to reduce carbon emissions and aim to keep warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. That commitment is important. There was money behind it. There was some legally binding portions to it. But the key point missing is this point that I said the public is getting, which governments are not getting and is not in the agreement, which is the need to keep fossil fuels in the ground. So the United Nations itself has said, at a minimum, 3/4 of existing fossil fuels need to stay in the ground to avert the worst of climate catastrophe. The Paris Agreement, nowhere in it do the words oil, natural gas, coal, fossil fuels appear. It's all about stopping emissions, not stopping production. And that allows, for example, the government of Saudi Arabia to have a plan within the climate agreement, which is that they're going to increase domestic production of oil and gas
export it out of the country and use that money to fund alternative energy development at home. That's just backwards.
Interesting that President Obama was in Saudi Arabia this week, this Earth Day week.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, obviously, you know, our relations with the Saudis encompass a lot of things. Oil is certainly one of them. And there is a lot of debate right now about trying to get, for example, Saudi Arabia to choose to reduce that production to help address the price of oil at the same time as agreeing in the Paris Climate Agreement to allow them to produce more oil and gas to save the climate.
We've just got 30 seconds on this 46th anniversary of Earth Day. What are you celebrating, Antonia Yuhas?
I'm celebrating this movement, the Keep It in the Ground movement. All across the United States this week, there have been protests trying to halt new leasing of oil and gas development, including, you know, as I said, in the Gulf of Mexico. And really this global movement that is getting much, much, much larger to keep it in the ground and see those answers, even in response to appropriately responsive government and industry.
I want to thank you, Antonia Yuhas, for being with us. Our new report in Rolling Stone headlines, 6 years after BP Gulf oil spill, residents demand no new drilling. Her piece in Newsweek, Paris was just a way station in the climate change fight. We'll link to all her pieces, including her one in Ms. Magazine about women in the climate change battle. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, Boulder is debating whether to become a sister city to Nablus in the Israeli-occupied West Bank. We'll host a debate. Stay with us.
Others will curse me, but that's all right.
That's all right.
For I will watch them.
Seven by Prince. It's hard to say the late, great Prince, but Prince has died at the age of 57. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman on our 100-city tour. Today, we end today's show with a look at how Boulder, Colorado, where we're broadcasting from today, the state of Colorado, we're in nearby Denver, Boulder is debating an international conflict. This week, the Boulder City Council agreed to hire a moderator and convene a citizen panel over a proposal to make Boulder a sister city of Nablus in the Israeli-occupied West Bank. A group of residents applied to the Boulder City Council to recognize Nablus as a sister city, writing, quote, "Boulder and Nablus have so much in common, they are natural sisters for each other." But the city council rejected a previous effort to recognize Nablus as a sister city in 2013 after a contentious hours-long hearing.
One of the concerns we have is, number one, the scope of the human rights violations is enormous here. And this is not just based on my say-so or Israeli information. It's based on Palestinian reports as well that are reporting egregious conditions in Nablus and in throughout the West Bank with respect to honor killings of women, with respect to persecution of gays, with respect to torture, with respect to desecration and lack of access to Jewish religious shrines, multiple times.
For those who claim that they're appalled by human rights issues, they should be appalled by human rights issues. It is appalling. It is appalling the way that Israel is impoverishing the Palestinian people in the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip for 40-some years now.
So we turn now to a debate between two Boulder residents. Asriya Charon is board chair of the Boulder Nablus Sister City Project, which applied for Nablus to be officially recognized as a sister city of Boulder. And Bruce Schaefer is a retired attorney who opposes the plan. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Interestingly, maybe this can happen only in Colorado, you both came in on the same car, so you've been together for an hour debating this. But I want to start with you, Asriya. Explain why it is you have been pushing for Nablus to be the sister city to your city, Boulder.
Well, the reason that I've been promoting and working on a sister city relationship is primarily because of my own journey in terms of having spent time in Palestine and recognizing that the people of Palestine are portrayed quite the opposite of how they are in real life in mainstream media. I'll say not on Democracy Now!, but in most media portrayals in the United States, Palestinians are depicted in the darkest of lights, and most people really struggle to even conjure an image of a Palestinian person who could be just like you and I, you know, sitting around a table at a TV station in Nablus. And indeed, you know, they are. And you know, it's in my visits to Palestine, it became quite evident to me that the people of the United States need to have opportunities to get to know Palestinians.
So what would it mean to designate Boulder as an official sister city of Nablus?
Well, you know, it's actually a mere formality. It doesn't signify much. It's a procedural event. So when we apply to city council, council has this resolution 631 that dictates the confines of our sister city relationships, and they've enlisted a bunch of criteria that they ask any group of citizens to meet. If any group of citizens wishes to create a sister city relationship, they are welcome to do so. Right now we have 7, and these are the criteria. This is the resolution we must follow, and so we took it upon ourselves to do as they've asked, and then we take it before city council, and the procedure is essentially, did you hit the criteria? Yes or no? If you did, then boom.
So, Bruce Schaefer, what's your problem with this?
The problem, Amy, is, first of all, that the project is essentially political in that it serves the purpose of advocating for Palestine. And one may do that as a private organization, but under the city's resolution that establishes the sister city framework, the sister city relationship may not be political. That's one objection. The second one is that the resolution requires that the sister city emphasize human rights. And in this case, the project turns a blind eye to some very severe human rights abuses in Palestine. The third is that, in fact, this sister city relationship fails the common interests and characteristics test required under the resolution. And I would add, fourthly, that the conduct of the Sister City Project to this date does not demonstrate that they'd really be a good ambassador for Boulder.
Hmm. I wanted to turn to some of the letters written by Boulder students and their pen pal to their pen pals in the West Bank as part of the Boulder Nablus Sister City Project. In one letter, Boulder student Ellie wrote to pen pal Misk in the West Bank, quote, "I'm glad to hear from you again. Your summer sounded a lot like mine." Another student, Hannah, wrote to pen pal Massa, quote, "Will you tell me about Eid? I'd like to learn about other holidays." And Misk, a Nablus student, wrote, quote, "Dear my friend in America, when I will be big, I want to be an eye doctor so I can help people."
Can you talk, Asriya, about what Bruce Schaefer just said and what it means to formalize? You're already operating as a sister city informally.
Yes, we're operating exactly as all the other sister cities currently do. And so to his point about this being a political organization promoting, a Palestinian perspective.
Well, he said it's political.
It's political, okay. And so it's difficult to separate out politics from life, and so our goal is, and this is why President Eisenhower established Sister Cities International, his political aim was to foster a more peaceful world. And so in encouraging cities to reach out to each other, and perhaps even the more the challenging cities to reach out and create relationships will promote a more peaceful world, which is a political outcome. But what I would clarify, though, is that there's a difference between political realities and political advocacy. So Mr. Schaefer has enumerated all sorts of examples of when we've sent volunteers to Nablus, and they come back and they talk about their experiences. And their experiences include, they're not completely, but they do include discussing the political realities of the citizens of Nablus. And the project itself stays out of politics. So we engage citizen-to-citizen opportunities.
Boulder has an interesting history with sister cities. Bruce Schaefer in the 80s, when President Reagan was supporting the Contras in Nicaragua. Yes, you had a sister city from Boulder to Nicaragua. Could you see a moment, now there's mediation that's been set up, where you could accept Nablus as a sister city? What would Asriya's group have to do that would satisfy your concerns?
And, Amy, let me make clear, I express only my own concerns. I don't sit here representative of any group or organization. They would have to gut the program of the political advocacy that they engage in. The mayor, in establishing this relationship, said, go home and advocate for Palestine. Project Hope, which is the destination for their volunteers, say, go home and advocate for Palestine. As Rhea Sharon is on record of saying, we're in this to present a one-sided perspective and to end the occupation. And back home, that's exactly what we hear from the volunteers. That's our end of the exchange, is tales of the occupation.
Bruce,
and,
let me ask you
something. I did teach a bit.
Would you be for the end of the occupation? Would you support the end of the occupation?
Yes.
And, well, let me end with Asriya. How many other...
It depends how it ends.
Let me end with Asriya. How many other cities in the United States are sister cities with Palestinian cities?
There's four cities in the United States that are sistered with Palestinian cities.
They are?
Yes. They are...
Among them.
Yeah, there's Gainesville, Florida, that also has a sister in Israel. And there's Cambridge, Burlington, Sacramento. They're all sistered with Bethlehem.
I'm going to leave it there. Okay. It's an interesting discussion. We'll continue to follow it because it's being mediated in Boulder, and it's clearly going to go on. That does it for our show. Thank you so much to Asriya Sharon, board chair of the Boulder Nablus Sister City Project, and Bruce Schaefer, attorney and opponent of the proposal. That does it for our show. We're on our 100 City Tour. I'll be speaking at Colorado College in Colorado Springs tonight, then Eagle, Carbondale, Paonia, Salida, Taos, New Mexico on Saturday and Sunday. Check our website at democracynow.org. We'll be in Albuquerque on Monday and Santa Fe on Tuesday. Special thanks to Amy Littlefield, Dennis Moynihan. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.